Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is it so hard for low-income Americans to break the cycle of poverty for themselves or their children? With unemployment rates still unacceptably high, it is easy to assume that most poor families' problems could be solved if only we could get everybody working again. In fact, close to two-thirds of families living below the poverty line have at least one employed member. But as my guest today will tell us, millions of U.S. families remain deeply vulnerable to what for middle-class families are just minor setbacks, and many find it impossible to get ahead no matter how hard they work. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Shipler is the author of multiple books, including The Working Poor, Invisible in America, which was a finalist for the 2005 National Book Critics Circle Award. He'll be in town later this week to address the Community Financial Stability Summit, which is sponsored by the United Way of Metropolitan Dallas. You can learn about the United Way at unitedwaydallas.org. David, welcome back to Think.
Nice to be with you.
What does the term working poor actually mean?
It means people who have jobs but who are earning incomes below the poverty line, or if not below the poverty line, barely above it, not far enough above it to make any difference in their living standards compared with those who are technically in poverty.
You wrote in 2004 that it is time to be ashamed of the plight of the working poor in America. Has anything changed since then?
Things have gotten worse, actually. You know, the downturn that began in 2007-2008 has pushed more people into poverty. The rate now is about 15% nationwide, higher in Dallas and up many other cities. So we're not in better shape, generally speaking. You know, one of the problems is that the panacea of just get a job doesn't work when you have very low skills and are paid very low wages. So, for example, the poverty rate is determined by the Census Bureau, and it's calculated for a family of four with one adult, three children, is about, I think, $22,000, a little more than $22,000 a year. And if you do the math and you figure that someone working 40 hours a week, that is a full-time job for 52 weeks, makes, the minimum, the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, they're below the poverty line. You have to make almost $11 an hour just to get to the poverty line. So a lot of jobs just don't pay that much.
How does what you call the American myth play into the way we conceive of poor people as somehow being the engineers of their own fates, even if they are fully employed?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the working poor are not seen as poor because they wear the camouflage of a job.
Mm-hmm.
They look as if they're okay because they're cashing a salad in the stores, they're stocking shelves, they're picking vegetables, they're doing essential work, and they're working hard and long hours. And therefore, according to the American dream or the American myth, they ought to be prospering. I mean, if you work hard in America, you are supposed to be able to prosper. This is a long-standing myth, and I wouldn't dismiss it. I mean, you know, myths are very important to societies, and this one's important to us because it sets a very high standard. And I think we all yearn to bridge the gap between that standard and the reality, which is something quite different. The trouble with the myth is that it's only one side of a coin. The other side is what I've come to think of as the anti-myth, because if it's true that anyone who works hard can prosper, then the logic tells you that those who aren't prospering are not working hard. This is not the case, but it's a common belief among many people in America that the poor are lazy, the poor are not putting all their effort where they ought to, and they're responsible for their own conditions. So I think we have to kind of, that's the, you know, one side of the ideology. We have two completely different views of poverty on the right and the left politically. You know, the right looks at the poor as responsible for their own fates. The left tends to see only societal institutions as to blame. And I think we need to get past this ideological divide and understand that the dynamics of poverty are much more complex. People are there for a variety of reasons that don't fit neatly into the ideological or political boxes.
So, in other words, it's a combination of both things.
It is. I mean, I spent 5 years or so following the same families and individuals and watching them and talking with them and hearing from them. And I tell you, it was very hard to put anyone in either of those neat boxes, you know, where you could blame only the society's institutions or only themselves. I mean, people suffer from a multiple of factors, some of which are of their own making and some of which they have no control over.
Talk about this. Occasionally you will hear about someone who has encountered someone who is in poverty and just be really bothered by the fact that they own anything besides like a kitchen table and a mattress to sleep on. In other words, the presence of a television set or a computer will tell people, well, they must not really be poor. Can you talk a little bit about how poor families make decisions about the things that they'll acquire and how much they'll spend for those as compared with other goods and services that we might consider necessity?
Well, this is a very important question. I'm glad you asked it, Chris. It's a complicated one. First of all, we have to understand that poverty is relative. A Vietnamese farmer who owns a couple of acres of rice paddy and a water buffalo to plow is not poor in Vietnam. But a Mexican farm worker who harvests cucumbers and gets paid by the bucket and is jammed into a small room of a cinder block barrack in eastern North Carolina is poor in America. So poverty is relative. When people provide essential services to an affluent society but can't participate in that society fully, when they're standing at the margins looking in, by our definition, they are poor, they're marginalized, they're outside the system. I mean, I met a woman who could not afford to put her own two children in the daycare center where she worked. I got to know a woman who was filing checks in the bank in the back room of a bank when she had about $2 in her own checking account. Mm. So these are folks who, you know, they wash cars but can't afford to own one. That kind of disparity in the United States is partly part of a definition of poverty. Now, you ask about computers and TV sets. I think that, first of all, people need to participate in the society as fully as they are able. And access to the public square, so to speak, is now through the internet and through television. And in most places, practically all places now, in apartment houses, for example, you know, you have to have cable. I mean, you can't get television with an antenna. So you've got that subscription fee. If you're going to participate in the broader society, know what's going on, be aware, be politically aware, and so forth. It's not really a luxury anymore. It used to be when I first started working for the New York Times in New York, there were rules against welfare recipients having telephones because they were considered a luxury. Hmm. So you can see how far we've come, and I think that's part of what we have to adjust to. We have to kind of adjust our eyesight to what the mainstream of the society consists of, what kinds of benefits and luxuries, we might call them, people, you know, can take advantage of, and what, you know, limits there are on people's ability to pay for these things. I mean, and I would add here that a couple of the families I asked to keep track of their expenses for a month just because I wanted to see where their money went, what little money they had. And they were pretty shocked, actually, by what they were spending money on, just as I was once when I did this. But the difference between them and me was that I had a cushion. I had room to make mistakes. You know, I could do something foolish and overspend on something and not have my living standard affected by it. But people who are in poverty are living very close to the bone. They really don't have savings, and they can't afford to make these mistakes. So every bad judgment, bad choice, has an impact that's much greater than it would be for somebody like me.
Hmm. Talk about, you alluded to childcare a little while ago, and this is a really huge issue, particularly for single parent families, but not exclusively. There is the issue of access and affordability, and then for some families, there's the issue of childcare centers catering largely to people who work 9-to-5 jobs, and lots of jobs for the working poor don't happen within those hours.
That's right. I mean, people work swing shifts, night shifts. Sometimes their shifts change, and sometimes they don't have any control over their changes in shifts. The boss says, you know, I need you at 1 p.m. tomorrow, you know, 1 to 9 or 1 to 8. So they've got to come in. And people who are at low-level, low-wage jobs often don't have any, you know, coin of prestige to spend on the job. I mean, they can't say, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do that. My kid comes home from school at 3:30, and I got to be there, and you haven't given me enough notice for backup. I mean, there are plenty of people lined up at the door who want that job that doesn't require even a high school diploma, so you can be out the door. And, you know, one problem in the United States is the decline of labor unions to protect people at the workplace from these kinds of shifts and changes. It's only now, I think, in the private sector, only about 7.5% of workers are unionized, which means we practically don't have unions anymore. And I think that has made the lives of workers much more difficult. Employers do not have to be accommodating to family demands, especially in a bad economy where there are few jobs and lots of people looking for them. In a really booming economy, and I started this book actually in an economy that was pretty good, I found employers were actually trying to be accommodating to their employees, especially small businesses, because they didn't want the turnover. They didn't want people to keep leaving. Then they'd have to retrain people and that sort of thing. In fact, I met a guy in Chicago who's the third generation, not Chicago, Cleveland, I should say, who's the third generation of a family that owns a small manufacturing company. And he told me that when one of his workers didn't show up for work one day, he called him at home and asked him why. And the guy said, well, my car broke down. I can't get there. So the boss sent another worker to pick him up and bring him in because he wanted him to understand that if he didn't come in, a production deadline would be missed or he'd have to pull people off another job to get the work done. And that's a pretty rare situation, but it's something that illustrates a very important point, which is that many people who have low skills and have failed repeatedly don't have a sense of self-esteem. They don't think they're important. And as one woman said to me when I was telling her about bosses complaining that people weren't showing up at work, she said maybe they don't think they're important enough for anybody to care if they come or not. So you have all these factors kind of, you know, wrapped up in together in a situation where it's hard to unravel the causality. You know, it's hard to trace the cause of one problem to another problem. Child care is a huge issue for single women. And by the way, most poor families in America are headed by single women, just over 50%. So when you have someone who goes off welfare and is required to by the welfare to work law and gets a job, you know, she needs a lot of things that she didn't need when she wasn't working. She needs transportation, and almost all workers require personal automobiles to get to work. Public transportation is inadequate in most of the country. She needs a wardrobe of some kind, you know, depending on the job. And, of course, she needs child care. Sometimes people can rely on relatives or neighbors, and there are a lot of informal systems where the grandmother will take care of the kids. Or if the kid's school age, of course, the kid is in school, at least up until the end of the school day. But what happens if the child is sick? Then, you know, he or she has to stay home. Maybe the mother has to take the child to the doctor. She risks losing her job. She certainly loses the pay because she's being paid on an hourly basis, not on a salary basis. So all of these things begin to form chain reactions in people's lives that can lead to really serious downward spirals. I mean, I'll give you an example.
You know, let me jump in. I want the example, but we have to take a quick break. My guest is journalist David K. Shipler. His 2004 book, The Working Poor, Invisible in America, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist David K. Shipler. Among his award-winning books is The Working Poor, Invisible in America, first published in 2004, updated a couple of years ago. He'll be in town Wednesday to address the Community Financial Stability Summit, sponsored by the United Way of Metropolitan Dallas. The event's not open to the public, but if you'd like to learn more about the United Way, you can go online to unitedwaydallas.org. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. And you were about to give us an example, David, right before the break of the things we've been talking about.
Well, you know, a boy came into the Boston Medical Center with asthma attacks again and again. Asthma, as you may know, is a rising problem among children in the U.S., especially poor children. And there's been a good deal of research in the last 20 years tracing some of the problems to poor housing, that is, roaches that shed their skin into a fine dust which is breathed in, mold, dust mites, this kind of thing, often found in poor housing, can exacerbate children's asthma. And when a child has an asthma attack, he or she misses school, the parent misses work to take the kid to the emergency room or the doctor. And what happened in this case was that the boy kept coming in and the doctors kept prescribing steroid inhalers, which is what you're supposed to do medically. But then they began to understand that the apartment that they were sending the kid back to was full of problems. I mean, they had mold and dust mites and so forth. So one of the medical people called the landlord and tried to get the landlord to clean it up, and nothing happened. So they got a lawyer to make the call. And miraculously, lo and behold, the landlord jumped in around and took care of the issues, fixed a leaky pipe, took up the old carpeting, and that sort of thing. And after a few weeks, the boy was back to normal, and the mother stopped missing work, and things were back kind of in a stable situation. The head of the pediatrics department realized that lawyers were a key to treating disease of certain kinds, and so he then ended up with 5 full-time attorneys on the staff of the Boston Medical Center's pediatrics department, paid for not by Medicaid, of course, but by private grants. And the ideas caught on around the country. There are some 200 medical legal partnerships now. Some lawyers just donate their work pro bono. But there's a recognition that the environment can be an exacerbating factor in terms of disease. And so you have here interlocking problems that don't seem related when you first look at them separately, but are connected. So it's important for us to connect the dots to understand poverty and how it works.
I want to talk about, you know, you mentioned that many working poor families have very little in savings, and one little setback, for example, a child who has to be out of school sick for a few days, even with something less dire than asthma, you know, if I need to take the day off, I have paid sick time and I'm free to do that. Lots of people don't get money if they don't show up on the job.
Yes, lots of jobs are paid on by the hour, period, and you don't get vacation time, you don't get sick leave. And more companies are outsourcing their work to private contractors, so they don't have to have full-time employees that are eligible for certain benefits. This correlates with skills, basically. You know, the people who have relatively low skills, who cannot find salary work at a professional level, are much more vulnerable in this regard than people who have college degrees and have professions. Now, there are a lot of college graduates who are also having these difficulties because of the job market. But in normal economic times, those problems are much more prevalent at the lower skilled levels. All of which comes back to the question that we've all in this country been talking about for many years, which is our schools and how we need to upgrade them, to put more money into them, to reduce class sizes, to make sure that kids are getting a good, solid education, and are then, I think, you know, given the opportunity for specific vocational and job training after high school, because with just a high school diploma, you're not necessarily that eligible for a higher-paying work anymore. I mean, it used to be that we had enough of an industrial base that there were ways of a high school kid going into his father's, you know, factory and being an apprentice on the job and then working his way up throughout an entire 20 or 30-year career. That kind of opportunity, that those rungs of that ladder are no longer as easily available. So I think we have to rethink our educational system and its structure. I think we also have to pay much more attention to early childhood nutrition and health. You know, it's been good brain science in the last 10, 15 years that, and it's advancing all the time, that really has nailed down the relationship between nutritional deficiency and cognitive impairment that can last a lifetime. So iron deficiency in infancy, for example, when those, even if it's restored after the kid is 2 or 3 years old, when you go back to those kids when they're adolescents, you see all kinds of problems, reading problems, math problems, behavioral problems, learning disabilities. So the nutritional deficits during critical periods of brain development, namely the last two trimesters of pregnancy and the first 2 to 3 years of life, can lower IQ and present other problems throughout a person's entire lifetime. And we have a hunger problem in the United States. There are malnutrition clinics. I spent time at two of them, one at Boston, one in Baltimore, where kids who are not eating properly, underweight, developmentally delayed, or brought in for treatment and help, and the parents are given advice. And a lot of this is just money. I mean, and, you know, if you look at the, here again, you see problems that don't seem related but are very tightly linked to one another. Housing can actually result in malnutrition among children. This sounds completely crazy, but let me just lay it out for a moment. If you don't have housing subsidies from the government, that is, if you don't have a Section 8 voucher that allows you to get a reduced rent or it pays part of your rent on the private market, if you're not in public housing, if you're just on the private market, now I don't know Dallas well, but most places in the country, a low-income family is going to be paying 50 to 70% of its income for rent on the private market. Now, that's not an optional payment. You have to write that check every month. You have to make the car payment. You have to pay the electric bill. You have to pay the cable bill if you want to have access to the public square and have television. These are not optional. What the part of the budget that can be squeezed is the part for food, and that's what families often do. They'll squeeze that food budget, the result being that the adults and some of their children may not get adequate nutrition, and that can have these cognitive impacts that carry over into school performance, and I think probably, I don't have any studies to cite on this one, but just my hunch tells me that if a kid isn't learning, isn't able to learn, and sits in a classroom all day not understanding half of what the teacher is saying, and kids have told me they don't understand half or more of what the teacher is saying, why would they stay in school? I mean, you know, you're not going to stay in school if you don't have to, when all you feel is disabled. Mm-hmm. And when you drop out of school, then you're going to earn less money, you're going to pay less taxes, your health is not going to be as good, you're going to have a higher probability of winding up in jail. There are all kinds of really bad things that develop from that choice of leaving school. So I think these problems are all connected with one another. And therefore, to address them, we have to understand the connections.
Is the problem that every time we come up with a solution, it looks at one of these things in isolation?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You know, government is structured very in a very balkanized way. You know, you have one department dealing with food stamps. You have another department dealing with housing. You know, you have congressional committees that handle different issues at different times. You know, the food stamp program is part of the agriculture budget, for heaven's sakes, you know. How does that make sense? And I think there's really very little coordination among the programs, and therefore you don't have a lot of people thinking in a broad, universal way about solving multiple problems at once. And this is also true in the private sector to an extent. I mean, there are some non-governmental organizations that do very good work, and they help people with multiple problems. For example, there's a food bank in Washington, D.C., Bread for the City, which does an intake when people come in for surplus food, and they ask them lots of questions about their housing, about medical care, and so forth. They have a clinic attached. They have at times had a lawyer who could deal with housing problems there. And so there is some of that. But the main institutions of the United States are not gateways into solving multiple problems. I mean, think about what schools could do. I mean, teachers see problems all the time. I mean, I've been told by teachers that they take granola bars to class so that when they see the vacant look of hunger in a child's eyes, they can toss them a granola bar because, you know, as one pediatrician said to me, learning is a discretionary activity. Hmm. You don't do it unless you're well-fed. And so when teachers see hunger in their classroom, all they can do is toss a granola bar. They don't have the ability to connect the family with the SNAP or food stamp program if they're eligible. There's no way in most schools that the teachers can look into or have some caseworker look into their housing problems. If a kid is absent often, is it because of asthma, for example? I mean, is there a housing issue that is exacerbating the asthma and might be addressed? Well, the teacher really is powerless to explore that. So I think schools could be made into gateways, probation offices, housing authorities, job training programs. I mean, there are lots of places where people come for services, but they need more than just the service they're seeking very often, usually, in fact. So, you know, if we wanted to really invest in our public good, we would do this. It would cost money, but we could do it. I think we have the capacity to do it. We certainly understand the issues. As a society, we have experts, specialists from neurologists to pediatricians to lawyers to economists who really do understand the dynamics of poverty. So the knowledge is there if we pooled it and mobilized it. And I think the resources are there if we wanted to harness them.
Resources and will are not necessarily the same thing. We've just passed through an election cycle where virtually every major candidate expressed great concern, prescribed solutions for strengthening the middle class in America. Hardly a word from either major party about the poor.
Exactly right. It was very disturbing. Not much of a word about civil liberties either, the other issue I've written about recently, which I think we talked about last spring. It's odd, you know. Obama, the Democrat, who's not as liberal as people think, I don't believe, really avoided using the word poor and poverty for the most part. He talked about people helping people get into the middle class. So I guess he was referring to the poor. But there's some idea, I guess, that if you're advocating for the poor, you're doing something that's politically unpopular. I'm not sure that's accurate, actually. I think that America is more generous than politicians give us credit for being. I've spoken about poverty in lots of places in the country, and not always to liberals who are working on the issue, but sometimes business people, executives, lawyers, judges, and whole entire college classes that are made up of conservatives as well as liberal students. And I've often asked them, how many of you would be personally willing to pay higher income taxes to help address the problems of poverty, and almost all the hands go up. But then I ask them, how many of you who raised your hands have told this to your elected representatives, have said to them that you're willing to pay higher taxes, and hardly any hands go up. So there's the gap between what people are willing to do and what the political representatives understand that they're willing to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with David in Wichita Falls. Hi, David.
Hi there. How are you guys today?
Great, thank you.
I'm a psychologist, and I really appreciate the discussion you guys are having today. It resonates with me at many levels because in my earlier life, I worked as a inner-city pastor, and there was one brief experience I'd like to tell you about that informed me a lot about the working poor and people in poverty. It was simply that one of my jobs as an urban minister was to allocate resources of an emergency assistance fund. And one day I was completely out of money when a mother came to me and said, could you put together just a few dollars? I have no food for the kids, and we need to get something for dinner. And so I reached in my own pocket and pulled out $20, and I gave her that. she said thank you profusely. And the next day I checked in on her to see how things went, and I said, how are you guys doing, and how'd it go last night? What'd you get? And I was thinking maybe she'd plan several meals with this money that I provided. And she said, well, it was a wonderful night, Pastor. Thank you so much. We went to Kentucky Fried Chicken and got some chicken, and we rented several videos. This was back in the 1980s, and went home and watched them. Mm. And that was so head-scratching to me at the time. I was new in that process, and it was actually that question that led me in some part to become a psychologist about what makes people do what they do. I'd be interested in your guest ideas, but to me it seemed to reflect a lack of hope. To look down the road and think that $20 was going to serve any major piece in her recovery with her family, but for one night they could feel normal. For one night they could say, we're like other families who can have some good food and some good time and watch a movie, and we'll worry about tomorrow. But I'm concerned that so many folks who don't understand these folks, and that's why I love this idea of the book that you guys are talking about today, is the idea that we, in understanding what these behaviors are driven by, then we can understand that we might be moved in the same way and that there's not that big a difference between us after all.
Well, David, thank you so much for your call. David Shipler, what do you think about that?
Well, that's a great story. It just operates at so many levels. I admire you, David, for the compassion with which you told it, because I think some people would have told that story with contempt for a decision made, badly. It's more expensive to go to fast food than to buy your own and cook it. People do make choices that, don't seem the wisest when you're sitting down and trying to work out how to make a dollar go as far as you possibly can. But it is important to feel normal, as you said, and to have that moment of joy or entertainment or kind of freedom almost. I think that, one of the families I asked to keep track of their expenses wrote down $50 a week for cigarettes. This was some years ago. I think it probably cost them more now. And I said, gee, that's a lot of money for cigarettes. And they kind of looked sheepish, and they said, yeah, we've been trying to quit. And, so, well, you'd have that $50 to do something else with. And, yeah, they understood that. And I said, then, I see you're going out all the time. You're going to Burger King and McDonald's and stuff.
Hold on one more second. We have to take another quick break, okay. David. We'll come back to this story in just a minute. We're talking to David K. Shipler, author of the 2004 book, The Working Poor.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist David K. Shipler. He is the author of the 2004 book, The Working Poor, Invisible in America. That was a finalist for the 2005 National Book Critics Circle Award, and it has been updated in the past couple of years with new statistics and an epilogue. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, David, you were telling us about one of the families that you had asked to sort of share their monthly expenses and budgeting with you, made some decisions that on the surface looked really hard to justify.
Yeah, and part of it was going out to fast food. They were both stressed out. They were, he was working long hours. She actually had some mental illness. So cooking was, they had, I think two or three kids, little kids. Cooking was kind of overwhelming. And also, I don't think they really knew a lot about how to cook. I mean, I was in malnutrition clinics, there was one couple who came in, and the nutritionist suggested scrambled eggs, and they looked blank, and they were native-born Americans. They weren't immigrants, so they should have understood scrambled eggs. And the nutritionist said, you know how to scramble eggs? And they said, no, and so she told them how. I think we can't, there's a lot about cooking, about shopping, and about managing money that really seems overwhelming to certain people. Financial literacy is a term that's been thrown around quite frequently to describe the skills that you need to figure out, how much interest you're paying on your credit card. And a lot of people don't, I've been told by people who do tax returns for folks for free that a lot of folks don't even understand what interest rate means. I mean, if you say, well, if you borrow $75 on a, you know, a $300, you know, loan from a payday loan place for 3 weeks or something, you're paying X 100% interest a year. That's completely foreign language to folks. They don't know. They don't understand it. So a lot of people, you know, sitting down, I mean, if they sit down with a budget and they go through it and they do it in a disciplined way, they can learn. But most people haven't really managed to do that. I mean, I think most wealthy people don't do it either. They don't need to. They don't get into trouble. The other issue about the story that David told about giving $20 to a mother and then, you know, they went to Kentucky Fried Chicken and rented a couple of videos, is that I found that a lot of people who are living day to day and don't have any savings actually have a sense of time and a horizon that's very close at hand. They don't have the experience of deferring gratification or planning ahead so that if they save something now, they'll have more later to buy something bigger with it. I mean, this is just not in their experience. They grew up often in families that didn't do this. They weren't able to. They didn't have the income to do it. They can't save money themselves. Every dime that comes in is going out for expenses. So there's no real life experience with looking ahead down the road 2, 3, 4 years, saving up for a car, that sort of thing. And I think that this is a psychological problem that's very difficult to address without increasing people's assets because, you know, unless they have the experience, it's all really quite hypothetical. I mean, and I think it carries over into areas besides money. So if you're planning, if you're saying to a kid in high school, well, you really need to get that high school diploma and, you know, you're smart, you can go to college, you know, and so forth, it's not so easy to persuade a kid who has no role models, who have college degrees, that this is anything that makes much sense. I mean, what's the point, really? I mean, do you get anything out of it in the end? Do you get and if you say, well, you're going to, you know, the average college graduate earns X amount more than the average high school graduate, that is still a concept that's a little hard to fathom when you're talking about doing something today that doesn't have an immediate return and an immediate value. And I think this is a big issue for lots of people who are trapped in poverty, especially those who have come from poor families themselves.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Michelle in Arlington. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Chris. I'm so glad that you can speak to me.
Welcome. We're glad to have you.
I just had a question for the author. If he could more go into explaining about generational wealth and how that affects a family's ability to move out of poverty at a quicker rate. Maybe you could speak more to that.
Well, that's a very good point, because obviously if you inherit money, you have a very good foundation to start with. And if you look at the differences, not just in annual income, but in assets, that is net worth, what the Census Bureau calls net worth, you see tremendous differences in the United States, and the disparities have been growing very, very quickly. So, for example, in 2004, the wealthiest 10% in the United States had an average household net worth of $3.1 million. The bottom 25% had an average net worth of minus $1,400. So they owed more than they owned. Now, that discrepancy changed with the downturn in the economy. In 2009, the top 10% average was $1.5 million. The bottom 25% was minus $4,900. But you can see the huge gaps. I mean, these are enormous gaps. And, you know, without a cushion, without a saving, without some kind of a, you know, some kind of inheritance or some kind of set of assets, you can get into a hole very, very quickly. I mean, a lot of people in this country have felt it acutely in the last several years. And once, you know, debt is also has also a big psychological impact on people because it makes them feel helpless. It drains their sense of capability. I remember meeting a guy who had no job for many years and had no health insurance, no dental insurance, never went to the dentist. When he had a toothache, he went to the emergency room, which
was required by law to treat him, but also could bill him. And he ran up a debt of about $10,000 in medical charges that he couldn't pay. And they damaged his credit rating to the point where when he did get a decent job as a roofer and was actually above the poverty line, his credit rating was so bad the phone company wouldn't even put a phone in his apartment. So that debt hung over him. And I said to him, how do you think you're going to get out of this? He said, I don't know. He said, I feel completely helpless. So, I think generational wealth being passed down is a very important thing, and it describes the difference in the way young people start out in life, that's for sure.
And, you know, wealth, inherited wealth aside and academic education aside, you also describe a set of what are called soft skills that allow people to thrive at whatever job they might have. Things as simple as knowing you have to show up on time every day or call somebody, knowing you have to wear a certain kind of attire, that you speak to your boss in a different way than you might speak to your brother.
Yeah, this is key. This is critical. I spent several months at a job training center in Washington, D.C., run by a Catholic organization, so others might eat. The people who came in, many of them could barely have a conversation. They had been defeated so often. They'd failed in school. They'd failed in relationships. They'd failed in job after job. They would look at the floor and mumble. And the courses they went through were structured in a way that they, as one instructor said, at least one small success could be experienced every day. And this instructor, who used to be he was teaching computer skills, and he used to be a Marine Corps sergeant, so he was giving them a lot of tough love, and he would have them stand up in front of the other trainees and give extemporaneous talks, and he would say, I can't hear you, look at me. And after several months, it was quite remarkable. People's eyes came up off the floor, their voices gained clarity. They began to have a sense of capability and believe in themselves. This is essential for doing well at the job, in the job market, because you have to be able to converse, you have to be able to interact with your boss, you need to learn how to manage your anger, and a lot of folks have come from really difficult, dangerous, often violent, domestically violent situations or violent on the street, where the culture is you get in the other guy's face before he gets into yours. But at the workplace, this is not exactly what you need, and you need to kind of do code switching almost and mm-hmm. learn to behave very differently. And as I said earlier, punctuality and calling in when you can't make it is important. And people who don't think that anybody cares about them and that they're not important, have trouble getting their minds around the idea that they need to call in when they're sick or when their kid is sick or when their car breaks down and that sort of thing. So it's a very complicated set of issues. I remember sitting with a group of young men who had been through a drug treatment program and were then in a halfway house for several months looking for work. That was what they were supposed to be doing, looking for jobs. And they had a support group that met every so often and to talk about what they were feeling as they were out looking for work. And the word that they used most often was surprising, because these guys were tough guys. They talked about their fear. That was the word they used. They were afraid to apply for jobs. They were afraid of being asked about their criminal records. They were afraid of being rejected. Some were even afraid of being accepted into jobs they didn't think they were capable of doing. And these were tough guys. They'd lived on the streets, some of them. They'd, been in prison. I mean, they were hardly people you would imagine feeling fear, and yet that was what they were experiencing as they were trying to venture out into the workplace. And I think that this is a whole kind of internal set of inhibitions and handicaps that really need to be addressed in the best job training programs that approach people in a holistic way and address these soft skills and the issues of self-esteem and belief in yourself that people carry around with them. I mean, these are big burdens that you have to get past if you're going to succeed.
You know, David, when we talk about needing to understand the situation that working poor Americans face in all its breadth and nuance, one of the oversimplified dichotomies that you don't sort of fall into here is this sort of good-bad trap between workers and employers. You take pains to write honestly, but not to demonize employers, many of whom don't have much more to give than what they're already paying.
That's right. I mean, first of all, on just the pay level, there are a lot of people in small businesses who are barely making it. I mean, their margins are small. And they're in highly competitive industries. So I spent time, for example, in the garment district of Los Angeles, where sewing shops pay by the piece often, not all of them, but many of them pay on a piecework basis. And they're in pretty ruthless competition with their neighbors and down the block or down, you know, in another floor of the same building. So they can't really afford to pay more. This one guy who owns a place, has owned it for many years, said that he takes home about $100,000 a year as his and his wife's salary together, I think he said. You know, these days that's fine, but it's, you know, they're not poor, but they're not exactly rolling in money. So that's one aspect. The other is, I think, that many employers don't have the skills themselves to address all of the problems that many low-income workers bring to the workplace. Often the families pass the buck to the schools pass the buck to the employers, and the employers are not well equipped to deal with the issues. And in fact, they're often baffled by them. One of the a foreman of a factory, a plastics factory I met, told me in a fairly good economy, and when there was a high turnover, and they didn't like that because they had to retrain new people all the time, they were puzzled by the reason that people were leaving, even though people were getting a fairly low wage and the working conditions were not very pleasant. There was a lot of plastic dust in the factory, noise, and long shifts, and that sort of thing. So they started doing exit interviews and asked people why they were leaving. And what they heard most often from workers was, nobody paid any attention to me. Nobody cared about me, which was quite interesting. Because so it wasn't the actual wages or working conditions. It was more the cold personal relationships that they found at the workplace. So this foreman actually assigned workers as mentors to new employees to try to, you know, make a difference in that regard. And then he left for another job, so I never found out whether he succeeded. But I think that tells you something about people's need for dignity in the sense that, you know, they want to be treated as whole human beings, and they want to feel good about their work, and they want to work hard. They want to perform well. I mean, of course, you can find a few lazy people. You find them at all levels of the economy, not just the low-wage levels. But by and large, the people I met and spent time with, I got to like very well because they just never gave up. I mean, they kept on going to work. They were very flexible. When their bosses ask them to change shifts.
Got to jump in here. We're out of time. David K. Shipler is the author of the book, The Working Poor, Invisible in America. David, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. That's also your source for the podcast. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.